In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, one God. Amen. Glory to thee, O God, glory to thee, O heavenly King. Comfort of the Spirit of truth, who art everywhere present, and fillest all things, treasury of good things, and giver of life, come and abide in us, cleanse us from every stain, and save our souls, O good one. Okay. Hello, everyone. I am finally getting to my recording of Catechism 14, our very final talk. I'm sorry, please forgive me for taking so long to get this recorded. It's been one challenge after another, and you may hear I'm a little bit stuffed up still, but that's okay. So this is talk number 14. I want to remind you of the aim of the entire series of lectures that we've given. It was really to center on the relationship that we seek with Christ in the church. This is the overall goal for everything we've done. Everything, every topic we've talked about was intended to go back to that main theme of what does our relationship with Christ in the church look like? How do we improve that relationship? And what do we seek to gain from that relationship? How do we seek to live in that relationship? So last time we spoke about seven spiritual powerhouses in the life of the church, all of whom have had and continue to have incredible influence on the lives of Christians today. And we left out a lot. We could easily have tripled that list, but we focus mainly on names that you will hear as Orthodox Christians again and again and again, and you will hear those names. Today we're going to do a similar thing, although we're going to focus mainly on modern saints and elders, and our hope is to get not through seven of them, but rather through nine of them. These modern elders and saints teach us what that relationship with Christ looks like and how it's possible to gain that relationship even in our own times. So in looking at these, we'll divide these up into a few different categories. The first three are saints who lived in the 20th century but aren't really considered all that modern anymore. The next two reposed in the 1950s and 1960s, and the final four would be considered very modern, with the dates of their repose spanning from 1979 until as recently as 1998. Keep in mind, again, that this list is extremely abridged. Just in holy figures that have lived in the last 100 years, I once gave a homily that listed 50 figures that were all right off the top of my head. So 50 figures in the last 100 years that would be considered holy figures, or this is saints of the Orthodox Church. And so many of them remain very, very unknown. But the ones we'll focus on today are better known and are kind of a representative group of that entire group of 50 that I mentioned. The other thing to know is that the amount of saints we don't know about far outshines the ones that God has revealed to us. This is a common theme that you'll see when the saints talk about saints. They'll say that there are many, many more saints that we don't know about that are hidden to man's eyes but known only to God. Than there are the ones that are revealed to us. Saints, by definition, they seek humility. And in humility, they seek not to be known by the world. And this is the same with holy figures even today. So there are many more that we don't know about, but many of them God deems necessary to reveal to the world so that we can learn from their lives and teachings. And this is really the goal here, is to learn from their lives and teachings and benefit from them. And so if we're not reading the lives of the saints, we are doing ourselves a great disservice, a fantastic disservice. This is really dangerous in the spiritual life, which is why you've heard me say, and I'll say again and again, that we should be reading the life or writings of a saint, especially a modern saint, at all times in our Orthodox lives. And I tend to read four or five books at a time, and one of them is always the life or writings of a modern elder or saint. And I find that these are the most beneficial to me. And so make sure that this becomes a habit for you, learning about these saints. The saints I'll talk about today, there are lives available for each and every one of them in English. And then again, there are many, many more that I'm not talking about that you can look up. So be sure to take advantage of the fact that we have so many of these great saints available to us and that we have so much available to us in the English language. Don't fall back on these, because these are what will give you a spiritual zeal and really a fuel spiritually for your entire journey as a Christian through the rest of your life. We will benefit so much from these things and be guided and taught how to live so well by these things
that, again, the way that we really harm ourselves is by ignoring them and not paying attention to them. And so make sure that you begin to collect a good library of Orthodox Christian lives of modern saints. And again, today we'll talk about quite a few of them. All but one have lives available in English, and the one that doesn't, I'll try and remember to mention to you where you can find out more about her. So, okay. So what do these modern saints do? Why are they so important? They show us that the church continues to work, that the church continues to sanctify and glorify people, and that the power that Christ gives the church over sin, the devil, and death are not mere theories, but real powers that manifest here and now. You heard me say a lecture or two ago that we should never ask the question, what would the apostles be like if they lived today? We know what they would be like because we have saints who are filled by the same Spirit, guided by the same Spirit, whose mouths are filled with the same grace and teach with the same grace-filled teachings. So this is what we look to. We look to the modern saints to speak to our modern times. They don't say anything necessarily new, but they say eternal things in new ways. This is the goal in the modern saints. So with that, we'll jump right into the first of these figures, and that's St. John of Kronstadt. Now, as I said, the first couple aren't really considered all that modern anymore. St. John of Kronstadt was born in 1829, and he reposed in 1908, so a little more than 100 years ago. He was born in a village in Russia. He was very, very pious from a young age, such that even while a child, the neighbors of his family would request his prayers. As a child, he studied very diligently, but he had a lot of trouble understanding any of his lessons. So he would go and he'd study and study, and he really wouldn't understand his lessons. He wouldn't remember what the teacher had said, and he was falling far behind his peers. But one night, while on his knees in prayer, he felt something rush over and through him. And suddenly, he was able to remember the day's lesson in detail, almost word for word. And from then on, he excelled in school, such that he was chosen to attend the Theological Academy of St. Petersburg, which at the time was a great honor. After graduating, he married, but he and his wife, from the very start, lived as brother and sister, rather than as a married couple. He really wanted to remain a monk, but he agreed to this arranged marriage, and so they lived as brother and sister. He was granted a dream in which he saw a church, and he saw himself as the priest. So when he was eventually ordained and assigned to the church, the cathedral in the town of Kronstadt, he immediately recognized the cathedral there because it was the one from his dream. Now, Kronstadt was an extremely rough city. It's where exiles and former prisoners were sent. So the streets were teeming with drunkenness, with homelessness, and with a lot of crime. But he was very, very generous to all. He was generous both with material things, including money, and with his time. And though he celebrated the liturgy daily, he would immediately go after the liturgy and minister to the people. And he was never content to just do a prayer and leave, but rather he would spend hours, if necessary, bringing people comfort and instruction. He also began teaching at a local school, truly bringing the Gospels to life in his instructions. The students were really amazed by his ability to take simple Gospel lessons and really make them alive before them, and so they had a great interest in the Scriptures because of his teachings. He encouraged people constantly in the spiritual life, teaching them to make frequent confession and receive communion regularly. He had so many people who wanted to confess that the bishop blessed him with a very unusual practice. So rather than having the time to do individual confessions, which there wasn't enough time in the world for that, what he would do is he would stand up before the people and he would hold his what we call the epitahelion, or his stole. He'd hold it up kind of over their heads, and he would read the opening prayer for confession, and then the people would begin to shout their sins at the same time as he continually prayed and wept. And that scene would go on for many, many minutes until everyone had confessed everything. And then he would finally read the prayer of absolution over everybody. And it's said by personal accounts of this actually happening that rather than being bashful, people would try to shout the loudest because they wanted him to hear their prayers and to make sure that they had his prayers for them. He was known as such a great wonder worker and man of prayer. He was known for many, many spiritual gifts. He knew who had legitimate needs and who was trying to scam him when they would ask for money. And so he would sometimes deny people money and warn people, no, this person is trying to scam you. He knew people's hearts and he knew their spiritual states. And in many cases, he prophesied future events in people's lives. Saint Siloam the Athonite who we will actually discuss in this lecture, and who reposed in 1938, said once that Russia was supposed to fall to revolution far sooner than it did in 1917. But the country was preserved. And he said the country was preserved by the prayers of just two men. First, St. Seraphim of Sarov, who we've already discussed, and then St. John of Kronstadt. He said these two men were so close to God and had such powerful prayers that they actually preserved the entire country for many years. St. John of Kronstadt wrote various homilies, which were very, very simple. He didn't get into deep theology. He just really simply instructed the people, but powerfully because of his own spiritual life. But the one thing he published beyond that was his spiritual diary. And it's a thick book called My Life in Christ. It was published a few years before his death, and it became an instant classic. I actually own a copy that had been translated in English and printed in England in 1906, 2 years before his repose. It's one of my prized possessions. But this is available in a couple different translations today. Nicholas Kotar did the most recent one. It's a very good translation, and you can get it in one or two volumes, but it's a book that everyone should have. It's a great, great daily reading book. It's not one you're going to want to sit and read 30 or 40 pages at a time. It's, everything's written just kind of in paragraph form. It's different ideas and different thoughts about various things, and it's not organized in any systematic way. But this is a great one to have on your nightstand, just, you know, before you go to sleep at night, or when you wake up, you know, read a page. Again, the teachings are very simple but very profound, and will really feed your soul. So that's St. John of Kronstadt. He's also known as St. John the Wonder Worker of Kronstadt. He was a great miracle worker, healed many people, and his grave became the source of many, many miracles even after his repose. Okay, next, one other that is not as much considered a modern saint today, modern being someone who reposed within the last 100 years, St. Nectarios of Aegina. St. Nectarios reposed in 1920, and so just over 100 years ago. St. Nectarios, it's kind of an interesting thing that the name Nectarios outside of Orthodoxy is not a well-known name. But inside of Orthodoxy, very well known. In fact, in our own parish, we have three different boys, one of them being my own son, who are named after St. Nectarios. And one of Father Justin's kids is named after St. Nectarios, the female version, Nectaria or Nectaria, depending on how you pronounce it. St. Nectarios is a really special saint to me. He's the reason that I first really began paying attention to my faith and living it, and he's the reason I was eventually ordained a priest. And so I promised him that I would name a son after him if he granted me a son, and so that's why my oldest boy is named Nectarios. St. Nectarios was born in 1846. He was a pious child from his youth, from a very faithful family, but the family was extremely poor. And they were so poor that at the age of 14, he had to travel away from his family to Constantinople in order to work and send money home. He had no money to travel, so when he got to the ship, the captain told him to walk around and come back in a little while. He said, "Oh, you know, you don't have enough money. Well, that's okay. I'll let you on later, but why don't you walk around a bit?" And he understood that the captain was just trying to enact some sort of ruse or trick in order to get him to go away and to leave without him. And so he walked away very sad. But when the captain was ready to depart, the engines just simply wouldn't start. And they kept working on the engines and kept working until the captain looked out and he saw this young boy on the dock. And the captain had an idea, you know, maybe there's something to this kid. And so he invited him aboard, and as soon as he did, the ship's engines began immediately. St. Nectarios worked at a tobacco shop. He would pack tobacco. And in order to make this job something a little bit more than a mundane work, he would write scriptural verses or sayings from the Holy Fathers on strips of paper and then pack them with the tobacco in order to bring spiritual benefit to those who opened them up. Once upon making a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, still as a youth, a storm began and broke out, and the crew and people on the ship feared for their lives. But St. Nectarios grabbed his cross, and it was a cross that his grandmother had given him, and it contained within it a piece of the true cross. And so he took this and holding it by the string it was tied to, he lowered it into the waters to pray for calm. And the storm actually ceased. But in doing this, he dropped the cross, and he feared it was lost. But when the ship reached the dock, there was a strange knocking that could be heard against the hull of the ship. And the crew was trying to figure out what the sound was, and eventually they went down, and what did they find? They found Nectarius's cross floating in the water and knocking against the hull of the ship and creating this loud sound, and so they were able to retrieve it for him. In 1875, Nectarius became a monk, and 2 years later, he was ordained a deacon. Due to his great piety and learning, he had learned not only in school, but had spent a lot of his own time studying, he was sent to the Patriarchate of Alexandria, where he was made a priest and eventually a bishop. And the people absolutely revered him. But his popularity stirred up jealousy among many other priests and hierarchs, and they convinced the patriarch, who St. Nectarius up to that point was very close with, they convinced the patriarch that Nectarius was engaged in immoral behavior with parishioners, and that he was actually vying for the position of patriarch, and he was trying to get the patriarch kind of pushed out. So the patriarch believed this, and so he was cast out of the patriarchate completely, and he was sent to Athens. But unfortunately, in Athens, the rumors followed him. So he lived in really poor conditions, especially as a bishop. It was a great shame, the conditions he was living in. And he could only get a job as a traveling preacher from the few parishes that would actually allow him to come. And a traveling preacher was not a well-respected position. And this was unheard of for a bishop. It was absolutely unheard of for a bishop to go around as a traveling preacher. But he accepted all as the will of God, and although he lived with a lot of pain over the slanders that had been caused him, for the people that loved him in Alexandria, they wrote him a letter just thanking him for his faithfulness and love and for all they taught him. And he would hold that letter in his pocket and go and read it whenever he felt really depressed. But otherwise, he just accepted this as the will of God, and he would spend his time first giving away all his salary to the poor, and spending many, many days and nights in prayer and just learning continuous prayer. It was said that he had such a great love for the Panagia that if you just merely mentioned her name, his eyes would well up with tears. He had such a love for Christ, the Theotokos, and the saints. So eventually he was given a post as the director of an ecclesiastical school known as the Rosarios Ecclesiastical School. And again, this is not something that would normally be given to a bishop, but there were those who understood that he had been slandered and they took pity on him and gave him this job. He would secretly do lowly tasks when people weren't looking. He was caught a few times cleaning toilets. But beyond that, he began to be known as a clairvoyant, a miracle worker, and an exorcist. And so many people began coming to him for healings from illnesses and cancers, or the possessed would be brought to him, and he would heal them immediately. He wrote many works at this time, and so he became known as a great theologian and one of the greatest theologians of the 20th century and the latter millennium of the church. Not very many of his works have been translated into English yet, but little by little things are being translated. He began mainly through letters, a women's monastery also. He revitalized what were the ruins of a women's monastery, and he had a group of young girls who had dedicated themselves to be virgins for Christ's sake, but had not yet been made nuns, and he made them all nuns. But because they were all new, they required a lot of specific care and guidance, and so he would guide them all. And after his years of service at the school, he retired directly to this monastery so he could direct it a little bit more closely. But unfortunately, St. Nectarius' life, which was so full of slander, wasn't done yet. More rumors followed. And one of the rumors that was spread around was this disgusting and horrid rumor that he was having relations with the nuns, and he was then aborting fetuses and throwing them down a well. They actually had this investigated, and they found that none of it was true. The man who started this eventually, after his death, if I remember right, he repented of this and admitted that he had started this. But during his life, it was so full of these horrid slanders. But he never sought revenge. And he never received any accusations with anger. He always received them with peace, and he would maintain this incredible peace about him. His great spiritual life was known to many who were close to him. In one instance, a nun went to ask him something at the monastery, and when she knocked on his door and he didn't answer, she began to worry, so she opened the door. And what did she see? She saw him standing in prayer, only he was no longer standing on the ground. He was about 2 feet off the ground. He was floating in prayer. He eventually realized what she had seen and warned her not to tell anyone until after he had died. In 1920, he became very ill. He didn't want to go to the hospital. He just wanted to remain at the monastery, but the nuns finally convinced him to go to the monastery. And this is where a very famous a miracle occurred in his life, where after he reposed, he was sharing his hospital room with someone else who was a paralytic. And the nurses began preparing his body, and they took a sweater off of him and put it on the bed next to him where the paralytic was. And when the sweater touched this man, within an hour, he was up and walking, and declaring that Saint Nectarius was truly a saint. His relics were initially incorrupt. When they were first opened up years later, they found that he was completely incorrupt, but eventually they opened again and found that his body had decomposed and was now just bones. And one of his nuns, who loved him so much, was so upset about this, but he appeared to her in a dream. And he explained to her, "Don't you know that I asked Christ to do this? I want my relics to be sent throughout the world so they can bring healing and consolation to many people. And so I asked Christ not to allow my body to remain incorrupt," and that brought her consolation. He's seen today as a great hierarch in line with Saints Basil the Great, Gregory the Theologian, John Chrysostom, Spiridon the Wonder Worker, and many, many others. And there's a life. This is one of those lives I'm going to mention quite a few books to you today. But there's one life. It's called Saint Nectarius, a saint of our times, and there's another translation of it called The Saint of Our Century, but it's by a man named Sotos Chondropoulos, and this is one of the must reads. Everyone should really get their hands on this book, Saint Nectarius, a Saint for Our Times, or Saint Nectarius, the Saint of Our Century, and read this book about Saint Nectarius. It's a very, very moving book. Very few people can get through the whole thing without shedding some tears over this great saint. So that's Saint Nectarius. Okay. Next, we'll look at a saint we've already mentioned. That's Saint Siloam the Athenite, and along with him, we're going to mention an even more modern saint who was his disciple, Saint Sophronia of Essex, and that'll kind of be an aside to Saint Siloam's life. Saint Siloam was born in 1866 in Russia, and there were three important events that occurred during his youth that had great effects on the way he lived his life from then on. The first is in his family, they would take turns cooking meals. And one Friday, I believe it was a Friday, it was a fast day of some sort, but one fast day, he cooked a meal that contained some meat. And he said that his father, noticing that he had mistakenly made a meal with meat, didn't mention anything to him for 6 months. And only 6 months later did he very gently correct him. And Saint Siloam was always impressed with his father's gentleness in correcting others, including his own son. And so he always took that to heart. The next event happened when he was older. There was he was a large man. Saint Siloam was very, just naturally very strong and tall. And one day a man was kind of harassing him in the street, trying to impress a group of girls. And Saint Siloam kept telling him to leave him alone, but the man wouldn't do it. And so finally, Saint Siloam, with the hope of impressing this group who was kind of laughing at him, he punched the man in the chest. Well, that single punch was so hard, the man fell to the ground and nearly died. And it took him 2 months to recover from that one blow. Saint Nectarius was extremely terrified that he had almost taken the life of a man, and began to really contemplate what this life is about and the vanity of this life and what it will lead us to do. And he started contemplating more eternal things. But he forgot some of those lessons over time, until one night he was out at a tavern with his friends. They were all talking, laughing, drinking. And he was very pensive and very still. And one of his friends asked him what was going on. And he said he was sitting there wondering something. He said, "Well, what are you wondering?" He said, "Well, here we are, we're all enjoying ourselves, having a good time, laughing, being together. But right at this very moment on Mount Athos, there are monks who are struggling against sleep and comfort and standing in prayer. And they're praying for the salvation of us. And I'm just wondering, on the day of judgment, who will fare better, them or us?" And his friend kind of laughed at him and said, "Here we are all having a good time, and there you are on Mount Athos." But Saint Siloam really began to contemplate the meaning of eternity and what judgment would be like for him. So after his military service, he decided to go and meet Saint John of Kronstadt and ask for his blessing to become a monk. But Saint John wasn't there at the time, and so he left a letter. He left a letter asking his prayers, and eventually he left out for Mount Athos. He went to the monastery of St. Pantaleimon, which is the Russian monastery in Mount Athos, and his monastic life was lived in great obedience, but relative obscurity, really. His spiritual life was kept between him and his spiritual father for the most part, so very few understood just how advanced he actually was in the spiritual life. He was already having deep spiritual experiences early on that he really didn't understand, and eventually he actually saw Christ. Christ appeared to him and stood before him. So he went to this well-known monk for some advice on the spiritual life, and he got his advice and got some help with some questions he had and some struggles he was having. And as he was leaving, he heard the monk say, "If you are like this now, what will you be like as an old man?" And that little comment, that tiny comment, planted a small seed of pride in him. And so, though he continued to strive in prayer and labor and service and obedience, externally being an ideal monk, internally, all of the grace and peace that he felt after Christ had appeared to him receded, and it became a daily torment for him. This daily torment of a spiritual life, where no matter what he did, no matter how hard he worked, he never attained to those heights he had attained to before, lasted for 15 years. And then one night, as he went to do a prostration before his icons, the devil appeared before him, hoping that this monk Siloan would prostrate to him instead of the icon. And Saint Siloan, in despair, finally gave up. And he sat down in a stool, and he asked Christ what he should do. But then he heard in his heart these words, "Keep thy mind in hell and despair not." And he immediately understood that this was a call to humility. There's really much we could say about these profound words. I would recommend reading his life and reading the writings of Archimandrite Zachariah to help explain what these words are. You can find articles online from Archimandrite Zachariah about these words that kind of explain the depth and meaning of them. Keep thy mind in hell and despair not. Archimandrite Zachariah is the spiritual child of Saint Sophroni, who was the spiritual child of Saint Siloan. So he's like his spiritual grandchild in a way. And he's done a lot of work explaining the theology of Saint Siloan. Well, at this moment that he heard these words, "Keep thy mind in hell and despair not," his spiritual state was restored. And he lived the rest of his life in great humility and continually advanced in the spiritual life. He reposed in 1938. He was known as a man of great prayer, but really as nobody who was all that special by most of those who knew him. But in his last years, he had taken on a disciple, and the disciple is Saint Sophroni of Essex. We're not going to go over Saint Sophroni's life, which is incredible in and of itself. He's a really, really amazing man, one of my favorite authors, just an astounding saint of our times. Saint Sophroni reposed, by the way, in 1993, so he's a very recent saint. But he was a close disciple of Saint Siloan. I think he was his only disciple, really. And eventually he wrote Saint Siloan's life and teachings, and that led to Saint Siloan's glorification as a saint. Those who were alive who had known Saint Siloan read this life and were amazed at what they had in front of him without even realizing it. Saint Sophroni, by the way, eventually started a monastery in Essex, England, and this is where he took the teachings of Saint Siloan. Saint Siloan was relatively uneducated, but his teachings had such depth about them. Saint Sophroni, on the other hand, was very well educated, and so he applied theological language to the teachings of Saint Siloan and put them in words. The life and writings of Saint Siloan were written in Saint Sophroni's book called Saint Siloan the Athenite. This is probably the most important book of my life. I've never read a book that has had such a great impact on me. It is a tough book at times. The first half, the life of Saint Siloan, is also an analysis of his teachings, and that analysis is really difficult. Saint Sophroni goes into depth with deep technical theological language. If you read it, just push through those areas. Just keep reading until you get to a part you understand again, and you'll find benefit. Then you get to the second half, where Saint Siloan, his writings are he would just write on scraps of paper, but these were collected and put in the second half of the book, and they're so simple, they're so profound and so deep, and as you read them, you'll notice. I mean, this only a grace-filled person could write like he wrote. his main theme throughout much of his writings was the theme of love. And he talks about how love of enemies is the test of grace. Do you have grace in you? Do you love your enemies? He says, if you love your enemies, it's a sign that you have grace. Whereas if you hate your enemies, it's a sign that you have a demon in you. It's a tough saying. But when you read his words, they're so inspiring, and they'll really bring you a lot of benefit in the spiritual life. And so it's a thick book, about 800 pages, St. Cyril on the Athenite. But again, it's one that everyone should have in their library. Okay, that's St. Cyril on. So fourth, we're going to talk about St. Joseph the Hesychast, and we'll talk about his brotherhood. St. Joseph the Hesychast was like a modern St. Paisius Velichakovsky, who we talked about, in that he revitalized monasticism on Mount Athos and beyond. In fact, it's hard to find a monastery today that hasn't been influenced by St. Joseph in some way. He was born in 1897. At the age of 23, he was engaged to a girl, but he never touched her out of piety and fear that he would kiss her and ignite lust in himself. And so he always kept himself at a distance from her. But then he had a dream. And in the dream, two angels, in the appearance of palace guards, led him to venerate this great king. And he recognized that he was being called to something higher and more dedicated to Christ. And so he became very pensive after this. He lost all interest in worldly things and devoted himself completely to prayer and to the reading of the lives of the saints. So he broke off the engagement. And after 2 years of living ascetically in the world, he finally traveled to Mount Athos. And like Paisius Velichakovsky, he sought all over for a great spiritual guide to teach him unceasing prayer. He couldn't find one. He did find some men of great prayer, but they wouldn't take him on as a disciple because they wanted to live in solitude. And one of those was a man of great prayer and discernment named Daniel of Katanakia, who is now glorified as a saint himself. And Saint Daniel recognized that his brotherhood's asceticism was not nearly as austere enough for Saint Joseph. So what he did is he gave him some personal instruction, and then he advised him to go to a cave and practice prayer and only come to him every now and then for advice. In the cave, St. Joseph struggled greatly with temptations, but he persevered in prayer until he was granted a vision of the uncreated light. And at that moment, God granted him unceasing prayer. So that which he sought from great elders to teach him, now God granted him directly. And this unceasing prayer really continued on in his heart for the rest of his life. Saint Daniel of Katanakia, he had been searching at the time for a co-struggler with Joseph. He thought that he needed someone to struggle with him and to make sure that he didn't fall into delusion. And finally he found this very simple but very pious monk named Arsenios. And he sent him to the cave with Saint Joseph. And the two formed a really very, very austere brotherhood, where they would keep long vigils with very strict fasting, and many monks attempted to join them, but they wouldn't even last a single week. Early on, Arsenios, now known as Elder Arsenios, he recognized that Saint Joseph, although he had been a monk for a shorter time, had advanced beyond him, and so he convinced him to be the head of their little brotherhood. And little by little, monks would start to join this brotherhood. It always remained relatively small, but those who could take the austere life would join, and they realized that in Joseph they had a great saint leading them. Saint Joseph experienced many very exalted spiritual states. He even took a tour of heaven. He physically battled demons and had many, many visions. After 15 years at a little skete, this little monastic brotherhood in Mount Athos, known as Little St. Anne Skete. This is a very rocky skete on the edge of a cliff. His health caused him to move the brotherhood further down Mount Athos. And in 1959, the Theotokos appeared to St. Joseph and told him that he would repose on the Feast of Her Dormition, which is August 15th. The nucleus of St. Joseph's brotherhood consisted of five disciples. There was his co-ascetic, Father Arsenios, who we talked about. There was Father Athanasios, his brother in the flesh, who actually joined him. Father Joseph the Cypriot, who would later become the elder, or what's you'll hear in Greek the word Yeronda, the Yeronda, or elder of the monastery of Vatopedi, and is largely recognized as a saint as well. Father Ephrem,
later the abbot of the holy monastery of Philotheo, and the future Yeranda, or elder of 33 monasteries in Greece, the U.S., and Canada, including St. Anthony's Monastery in Arizona, again, known as a saint who reposed just a few years ago, 2019, I think. And then Father Haralambos, who was later the abbot of the holy monastery of Dionysio. And it's also noteworthy to mention that St. Ephrem of Katunakia, who died in 1998, he was never part of the Brotherhood directly, but he was a disciple of St. Joseph, would receive instruction from him. And again, he's a saint. So many, many saints came from their association with St. Joseph the Hesychast. Again, he reposed on August 15th in 1959. And his legacy was that his disciples went and after living as hermits on their own for a while after his death, they became the abbots of many of the monasteries in Mount Athos. And Mount Athos in the 1940s and 50s was on the verge of collapse. They had no monks. But St. Joseph's disciples really repopulated Mount Athos. And his legacy became so great that its influence, as already mentioned, is felt even here in America, where many monasteries have been built by his disciple, St. Ephrem, or Elder Ephrem, not officially glorified as saint yet, but Elder Ephrem now of Arizona. So again, it's hard to find a monastery today that hasn't been influenced in some way by St. Joseph the Hesychast and his revitalization of hesychastic prayer and a proper cenobitic monasticism. An absolute powerhouse of the 20th century. Okay, next, we'll talk about a figure whose relics are here in the United States in San Francisco, St. John of San Francisco, St. John Maximovich. And that'll lead us also to talk a little bit about Father Seraphim Rose. So St. John was born in 1896 in eastern Ukraine. His ancestor was actually another St. John Maximovich, St. John of Tobolsk, who was an ascetic of holy life, a missionary, and a spiritual writer. I forget if it was like his great-grandfather. I forget exactly what the relation is, but that was one of his ancestors. St. John attended a military academy and then law school. Before entering the law school, though, he met the eminent pastor and theologian, Metropolitan Anthony Krapovitsky. And Metropolitan Anthony took him under his guidance as a very close spiritual child, recognizing something really great in St. John. St. John spent much of his time reading the lives of the saints and other spiritual books. The Russian Revolution forced St. John to go with his family to Yugoslavia, where he began his formal theological education. Within a few years, he was tonsured a monk and made a deacon, and then a hieromonk, or a priest monk. After graduating, he began teaching at a seminary in Serbia. His already great asceticism was first noticed there, in Serbia, at the seminary. He attended or served liturgy daily, he ate only once a day, and he never slept laying down in a bed. Often he would fall asleep in mid-prostration during his all-night vigils. He would be doing prostrations and he'd grow so exhausted he'd fall asleep with his forehead on the ground that he'd wake up and just keep going. Another saint there at the time, St. Nikolai Velimirovich, he would point to St. John, to the students, and he would say, "This is a true ascetic and a man of righteousness, even a saint. You know, this, if you want to know what a saint looks like, look to this John, Bishop John." At the time, he wasn't a bishop. In 1934, St. John was made a bishop. And what happened was he received a letter informing him that he needed to take a train and go so he could be made a bishop. And on the train, a woman came to him and asked about him and what he was doing. And he said, "Oh, these bishops made a mistake. They're looking for some hieromonk John to make him a bishop. And they accidentally sent the letter to me." And so he just assumed that this must have been a different John. He was so humble. But when he got there, he realized it was him, and he was made a bishop. And on the train ride back, he met the same woman. And she said, "Well, what happened? Did you get it corrected?" He goes, "Oh, it's worse than I ever thought. They didn't make a mistake. They actually wanted me." And so from then on, he was a bishop. He was assigned to Shanghai in China, where there were some Russian immigrants. He worked tirelessly. There was a cathedral that was, its building had come to a standstill, and he brought peace to the situation and helped finish it. He began an orphanage, and he constantly visited the ill. He would be seen visiting the ill in any weather,
without any shoes often, because he so often gave his shoes away. So it could be, you know, just storming outside, and he'd be walking to the hospital, making sure he visited people. And people began to notice that he would visit them in the hospital before they had informed anyone that they were in there in the first place. And so people began to notice that he knew things without them having to say anything. And he also had some miraculous power of prayer, and many people he prayed for began to heal very quickly. In 1949, the Russian flock in China was forced to flee. St. John led them to a refugee camp in the Philippines. And every night on this island of Tubabeo, he would bless the four sides of the island. And storms would pass over but never go through this campsite. As soon as they left, though, a typhoon tore through the camp and absolutely destroyed it. And so many people recognized that he was protecting them by his prayers. St. John wanted to protect his flock, but the immigration laws of the U.S. wouldn't allow them to go to the United States, and so he actually flew to Washington, D.C., where he had the immigration laws literally changed in order to allow his refugees to come to America. So they were brought to San Francisco, but he was then assigned to Paris in 1951, and then to Brussels. And he spent much of his time collecting accounts of Orthodox saints in the West that had been forgotten. He was surprised at how many saints there were in the West that the Orthodox Church had forgotten about. So he began collecting their lives and making sure that Orthodox understood, these are your saints. And he would tell them their lives and memorize their hymns, do services to them. There was a Catholic priest there once who pointed to St. John as proof that wonder-working saints still lived. He called him St. John the Barefoot. Again, he was always giving his shoes away to the poor. And he told his students, you think holy people don't live anymore? Look to St. John. John the Barefoot, he's a living saint. He's proof that holiness is still available. In 1962, he was assigned to San Francisco, where he again had to intervene with problems in the construction of a cathedral. And eventually he was taken to civil court. But even as people launched accusation against him, he was always peaceful. He never accused anyone. He would only accuse the devil, despite their constant slanders. They said that in court, as people yelled at him, it was as if he was in church. He was sitting so peacefully. In 1966, he was traveling in Seattle, and he was praying before the miraculous icon of the Theotokos, known as the Cursed Root icon. And he fell asleep in the Lord then, in front of that icon. That week, he appeared in a dream to one of his disciples, and he told them, tell the people, although I have died, I live. And so this began to spread around. His relics were very soon discovered to be incorrupt. Incorrupt relics, by the way, they tend to have what people describe kind of as a mummified look, but there's no embalming done. They're not actually mummified, because nothing is done to preserve them. It's just the grace of God. And those relics remain in San Francisco to this day. And you can go, and there's a glass covering over his casket. And inside of the church, the Cathedral of the Holy Virgin in San Francisco, you walk in, and over to the right, there's his tomb. And you can go and see his hands there, and place prayers under his tomb, and seek his intercessions. One of the things I want to mention about St. John is his relationship with Father Seraphim Rose. When he was in San Francisco, St. John met a young man named Eugene. And Eugene had been searching diligently for the truth, capital T truth. Eugene, although he had looked to Protestantism and various Eastern religions, he was never really satisfied with any of them. But he was so impressed with the personality of St. John and his grace-filled existence that he decided that he wanted to become Orthodox himself. So Eugene became Orthodox, and eventually he also became a monk. And he was given the name Seraphim at his tonsure. And so he's known as St. Father Seraphim Rose, someone you've I'm sure, come across already. Father Seraphim Rose reposed in 1982 at a relatively young age, in his 40s, I believe, after starting a monastery in Northern California. And his writings have literally sold millions of copies all over the world. One of the books that I would definitely recommend is the Life of Father Seraphim Rose. It's called Father Seraphim Rose, His Life and Works. And it goes in and out of publication. If it's out of publication, you can get it on Kindle. But if you don't want to do that, just wait and they'll republish it. I know they're working on a new version of it right now. But Father Seraphim Rose, His Life and Works, thick book. You'll look at it and say, are you kidding? Read this whole thing. It's a quick read, and it's a really brilliant book, and really, really helpful to American Orthodox. So Father Seraphim Rose is one of the most famous of the disciples of St. John of San Francisco, but St. John continues to have a great influence on Orthodox in America and really all over the world. People love him as they read about his life and read his homilies. Again, very simple, but very deep and profound. Okay, now we'll get into one of the most beloved of the very recent saints of the church, St. Paisios the Athenite. Athenite meaning of Mount Athos. St. Paisios was born in 1924 in Cappadocia. He was baptized by St. Arsenios the Cappadocian, who prophesied during his baptism that he would become one day a great monk. All the Greeks in Cappadocia were exiled when he was young, so his family eventually resettled in northwest Greece. Even as a child, he would pray for hours. He would often sneak off to this small nearby cave to keep vigil. And one day, a friend of his came and explained to him, you know, Jesus was just a regular man. And he explained to him all about evolution, explaining that man had come from apes. And he tried to convince him that Jesus could not have been God incarnate. And St. Paisios was extremely distressed by this. So he began begging Christ to show himself to him. But after some time, when Christ didn't appear to him, this young boy decided that Jesus was still worth following. He said, you know, I think he was the greatest man who ever lived. And if he's the greatest man, even if only a man, he's worth following, and so I'm going to dedicate my life to following him as best I can. And after making this decision, Jesus did indeed appear to him and explained that he wanted to see how Paisios would respond to this temptation. After his military service, Paisios made sure that his siblings were well cared for, and then he went to Mount Athos. He stayed at a couple of different monasteries before being tonsured with the name Avercios. So Paisios was not his original name, and his first name as a monk was Avercios before he was made Paisios. He would fulfill all of his obediences with this conscious joy. He would push himself never to grumble, never to allow any negative thoughts in, and he worked very, very diligently in this. After living in obedience for some years, he started to live in more seclusion, seeking stillness, peace, and prayer. After being elevated to the small schema, which is the second to last monastic stage, so you're made, you're tonsured a monk and then put in the small schema and then what's called the great schema, he was given the name Paisios, and he was sent to this small Greek village because there was this influx of Protestant missionaries who had been doing a lot of work and converting a lot of the Orthodox, and so it was decided to send him there in order to teach the people. While he was there, he lived in this run-down monastery in deep prayer and fasting, and his fame began to spread. People began to actually flock to him, and they'd seek him out for his incredible humility, his love, and his simple teachings. Eventually, he left, much to the people's sadness, and he went to Sinai. And after some years of great asceticism there, and many, many mystical experiences, he often said that he would never reach the state he was at when he was in Sinai. He essentially lived as a hermit. He'd have to travel for hours in order to get any food, and after he'd get the food, local Bedouins would come, and they'd find him and see him with his bread, and he would give it all away. So he often went without eating for many, many days, but he would just pray and pray and had many mystical experiences, and eventually he returned to Mount Athos. He became known for his incredible clairvoyance and insights. He had many visitations from saints, and he would battle the devil directly. In the last years of his life, he became incredibly well-known. People from literally all over the world would travel to Mount Athos to go to his little hut and just to spend a few minutes with him. There were so many incredible, miraculous events in his life. And so his daily existence was full of miracles. There are two large lives available in English for St. Paisios. I would say at least one of these must be read in order to understand what a great saint he was. You have to find at least one of them. One is by the monk Isaac, and the other is done by the monastery where he was buried, St. John of the theologian in Souroti, Greece. They're both great. They're both really, really fantastic books. They're different. The one from Higher Monk Isaac contains a section on the in the second half that's just his teachings, which I really enjoyed. The one from the monastery where he's buried, Souroti, is just a straight life. It doesn't have a second section of teachings. The teachings and miracles are embedded within the life. And as a life, I think that one's a better one. But the Hiramuk Isaac one with the teachings at the end is also just fantastic. So you can't go wrong with either of them, but one of those lives should be read. Again, they're thick, but it doesn't take long. Many of his writings are also available. They're still publishing the ones, his collected works in English, usually taken from recordings of him. But you can get, I think, four or five of the volumes now. They're shipped in from Greece, so they're expensive, but well worth your time. Two quick teachings from St. Paisios before we go on to the next saint of the church. One is on thoughts. He gives a really instructive illustration where he says that, thoughts will plague us no matter what. He says your thoughts are like, imagine your mind like an airfield or an airstrip. He said planes are going to fly overhead no matter what. These are thoughts. Thoughts are going to go overhead no matter what. He said just don't let them land. Very simple teaching, but very, very effective for us. You can't help but have thoughts that are brought to you, sometimes by ourselves, but often by demons. He said, just don't focus on any of them. Just let them fly overhead and act like they're not even there. Just swat them away. The other great teaching he gave was on bees and flies. He says there's only two types of people in the world. And he said he's had lived for some time at that point. And he said, as far as you could see, everyone falls into one of these categories. You are either a bee or a fly. So what's a fly like? A fly can find a beautiful field of fragrant and soft flowers, and it will search and search and search and search until it finds one piece of garbage. And then it'll land on that garbage, and that garbage will become its whole world as if the flowers don't exist at all. Whereas a bee can be on an entire mountain of garbage, and it'll search and search and search and search until it finds one flower. And when it finds that flower, it lands the flower, and that flower becomes its whole world as if none of the garbage exists. So again, this has to do with thoughts and making sure that we keep our thoughts positive about other people and always look for the good. And with that, this, we become full of gratitude and full of humility. So those are two of many, many teachings of St. Paisios that are very beneficial. St. Paisios reposed in 1994. So he's a very, very recent figure of the church. Along with St. Paisios, there's another figure who is also very well known as a modern saint of Greece. Of all the modern saints of Greece, these two are the best known, St. Paisios, and the second is St. Porphyrios. And so that's our seventh holy figure for the day. St. Porphyrios is another great luminary of the 20th century. He reposed in 1991. He was born in 1906. His family was so poor that after first grade, he began working to support them. And so imagine this second grader not going to school, but just working to support his family. In his youth, because he couldn't read all that well, he very slowly read the life of St. John the Hut Dweller, and he became absolutely inflamed with a desire to serve God as a monk. So at the age of only 14 or 15, he traveled to Mount Athos, and he placed himself under the care of two monks, these brothers, who became his elders. This is unusual to have two elders. Usually you only have one, because you need to place yourself in complete obedience. But he agreed to place himself in complete obedience to both of them. And so what they would do is they would often give him contradictory advice in order to test his obedience and humble him. And so he'd be doing something, and one of the brothers would come and say, why are you doing that? Go do this. He'd say, may I be blessed. And so while he was doing that task, the other one would come to him and say, why are you doing that? I told you to do this. Come on, what are you, a worthless monk? Go do what I told you. He wouldn't argue. He wouldn't correct him. He would just say, may I be blessed. And they'd go back and forth just to test his humility. He never talked back. He was always obedient. And what's more, he always endured everything with joy. One day he was collecting snails in the rain, and his back became absolutely soaked. And this began a life of illness and pain and sickness that carried with him to his death. He carefully read the scriptures and committed much of them to memory, and he would use them to battle against negative thoughts. So he'd have a negative thought, and then he'd find a corresponding scripture, memorize the verse, and make sure he always had that as a weapon. His first major visitation of grace happened by divine providence. He went to a chapel one day, and when he walked up to the door, he found that it was locked. And so he began walking away, but he saw from a distance this grace-filled monk named, who was known as Old Demas. And Old Demas was walking towards the church. And so Porphyrios decided to hide himself behind some bushes and watch Old Demas and find out what he would do when he came up to the door and saw that it was locked. Well, Old Demas walked up to the door, tried to open it, saw it was locked, and looked around, and he didn't see anybody, including Porphyrios. And so When he thought he was alone, old Demas began doing prostrations and praying. And while he was doing these prostrations, divine grace, like a light, fell down from heaven. And it landed on old Demas and enveloped him. But when it hit the ground, it started to spread outward. And as soon as it spread outward, it touched Porphyrios. And from that moment on, he was granted many spiritual gifts. He was able to see things happening at long distances. He was able to sit on a rock and tell you who had sat there before. Many other things happened to him. So he told his elders about these gifts that he'd been granted, and they told him to strictly guard these things and not share them with anyone. Now, what's really incredible, this all happened when Porphyrios was just 19 years old. At 19 years old, he was already experiencing these grace-filled wonders in his life. But his poor health continued, and his elders had to sadly send him back to the world to a monastery near his hometown. So he continued to live there in a strict ascetic life, and the local archbishop recognized his great gifts and decided to ordain him a priest. He was only 21 years old. At 21, he was ordained a priest, which is actually against the canons, but this is within what we call economia. It's a bending of the canons because they saw that spiritually he was much older than he was physically. As a confessor, he was very strict initially. He would follow the canon law very strictly, but he saw that this method didn't help people. It was too tough for them, so he became very gentle with them. He lived in a few different places, and then in the 1940s, he was able to finally settle at a polyclinic to serve as a chaplain, and he remained there for over 20 years until 1970. He'd ministered to countless souls, and many, many people would go to him recognizing his great gifts. He was able to just look at somebody and know if something was ailing them, know if prayer would heal them, or if they needed to go to a doctor, what doctor to go to. He knew details about their lives. He knew details about where they lived. He often could describe in detail where people grew up, even though he had never been there before. After leaving the polyclinic, he resided at a few different monasteries until finally he decided to rebuild a women's convent. Many people continued to visit him, and his gifts of clairvoyance and prophecy, his ability to diagnose illnesses, to find underground water, he was well known for that, and many other things astounded the people who met him. His purity of heart and ceaseless prayer had the greatest impact on people, though. This is what people were really amazed with. He just had such purity of heart, and he never criticized anyone. By the end of his life, he was blind and absolutely riddled with illnesses and cancers, and in 1991, he reposed. There are many books about him in English, but you should begin with the book Wounded by Love. This is his autobiography, which was made by compiling recordings he had made about different times of his life, and some of his recorded homilies written out. This is a book you want to read slowly, but everyone should have it. Wounded by Love by St. Porphyrios. Read it slowly. Simple, so much depth. And it's a high calling, but it's a beautiful, beautiful book. The main point that he makes throughout all of his teachings is very simple. Don't fight the devil head on. You'll lose. And the other problem is when you face the devil, your back is facing Christ. Rather, fight for Christ. Face Christ and let the light come in. And the light of Christ will drive away the darkness on its own. You don't need to fight evil head on. Just fight for Christ and his light will extinguish all darkness. Be driven by love. Let love be the motivating factor in life. And in that way, any sort of spiritual progress becomes possible for us. We can do what we think is impossible and really grow in the spiritual life if we're guided by love. This is Saint Porphyrios. May we have his prayers. What a great saint. Okay. Now we'll look to, we have two more. Elder Cleopa of Romania. This is the saint we'll talk about who lived most recently. He reposed in 1998. So he's a very, very recent saint of the church. He's not officially glorified yet, so he's still known as Elder Cleopa rather than Saint Cleopa, but the cause for his glorification has been taken up by the church in Romania, so it's only a matter of time. He was born in 1912 in Romania. He and his brothers, George and Vasily, would spend hours in prayer each day. His brothers really had a great love for prayer, and they would teach him how to pray when he was young. They would spend days reading the entire Psalter. I mean, the entire book of Psalms, all 150, you know, take you at least a few hours, and they'd kneel in their their attic and do the entire Psalter. Sometimes they'd hear banging while they were doing the Psalter, and as a young boy, Cleopa would kind of look around wondering what was happening. His brothers would tell him to calm down and say, it's just the devil. The devil doesn't like what they were doing. This, just ignore him. Don't pay any attention. So that shows you some spiritual maturity at a young age. He confessed with his brothers to this great and holy monk named Paisi Olaru, Elder Paisi Olaru, different from the Paisios we just talked about. This Elder Paisi Olaru was a great Romanian elder, also being considered for glorification. He entered the monastery of Sihastria at the age of 17, and he was assigned to be the shepherd of the sheep for the monastery, meaning that he was in the mountains with the sheep almost all week. He would come back on the weekends for services, but during the week he'd miss all these services, and he was saddened by this. So he confessed to this abbot his great regret that he'd become this monk, and he was never at these services. But the abbot informed him that as he would faithfully fill his obedience, and he was so attentive to his obedience and to prayer while he was away, he said, you know, I sense the church, and when I sense the church, I see you there, even if you're not. I see you it's standing in your stall where you're supposed to be, even if you're not. Because spiritually, you are there. So he would spend his days in fasting, prayer, and spiritual reading. He would often read the same texts again and again and again, committing many of them to memory. Many books, besides the scriptures, many books from the Holy Fathers. He'd become so engrossed in his studying that he'd forget to eat. So he'd unintentionally fast extra. And he learned continuous prayer there as well. He fulfilled this obedience for 15 years. So essentially, you're living almost as a semi-hermit in this state, and he never wasted a day. When the abbot, Eunikia was his name, was becoming too old and infirm to continue leading the monastery, he proposed Cleopa as his successor. He knew he was near death, and he said, I think Cleopa should succeed me. Well, this greatly surprised the brotherhood, because Cleopa at that time was just over 30 years old. I mean, 30-year-old to be the abbot was unheard of. And he had no formal seminary education. So they were a little shocked by this. But Abbot Eunikia recognized that there was great spiritual depth in this 30-year-old monk. And there was great wisdom that he had gained from his personal studies. And so while Elder Cleopa didn't want to accept this, the other monks, having been convinced by Abbot Eunikia, they were convinced. And they told him, you know, it's not up to you to reject or accept this calling. You've been called to obedience. And out of obedience, you have no choice in this. And so he became the abbot. But just a few years into this position as abbot, the Securitate, which is the secret police of Romanian communism, they arrested him. They put him in a basement for 5 days without food or water before finally releasing him, realizing they really had no charges against him. But for the next 14 years, he would flee frequently into the mountains, and he would hide for a year or more, and only returned to the monastery to be driven out again into the wilderness to hide from his persecutors. He spent a lot of time in the wilderness as a hermit, escaping the persecution of the Romanian Securitate. He would perform the liturgy on a tree stump in the wilderness, and like St. Seraphim of Sarov, he befriended a bear. He would pick two potatoes every day. He'd take one for himself and give the other to a bear. By the way, in no English text will you read that about him. I only know that because my wife's grandmother actually met him, and he told her that he had a bear out in the wilderness that he would feed a potato to every day. And he'd spend his days in prayer. He would pray some days for 10 to 12 hours. And this is where he was filled with such grace that he became the greatest Romanian elder of the 20th century. You can find a list of great Romanian elders, and there's dozens of them of the 20th century, but he was recognized by all as being the greatest. When he could finally return to the monastery without being pestered by the Securitate, his name spread throughout all Romania, and people began visiting him in droves. He showed incredible gifts of clairvoyance and a beautiful ability to teach clearly and precisely. He wrote many works that were very simple and instructive in order to simply reteach Romanians their true faith, this true faith that communism had spent so long trying to erase from the country. There's one great story I heard actually at Sihastria. I've been there a few times. What he would do is he'd sit outside of his cell. You can find pictures of this. And they had benches, and he would just sit there and just teach the people. And you can find videos of him on YouTube, and he would teach with such a gusto and authority. And people would come and listen to him and to be instructed in spiritual matters. And often his personality, his grace-filled personality, changed the lives of many. But when I was there last time, the monk who was with him at his death told the story that there was a woman once who went to she had a great love for him, and she wanted to meet him, but she wanted to bring a friend to meet him as well. So she brought her friend, and she was describing to her friend like how great this monk is. And then they were at this great distance, and the friend looked at this distance, and she sees Elder Cleopa with this big group around him, sitting outside, you know, on the porch of his cell. And she goes, "That's the guy you're talking about?" And she goes, "Yeah, that's Elder Cleopa. That's Father Cleopa, you know." And her friend goes, "That old man. That old man is who you're so excited to go see. Like, it's just some old guy sitting outside and talking. What is this?" Well, they eventually approached Elder Cleopa, and Elder Cleopa blesses this woman's friend, and he looks her straight in the eyes, and he goes, "Yes, this old man." The woman was astounded, because of course she was so far away, there's no way he could have heard her, but he would do these things all the time. There was another case where he was teaching outside, and with these big groups, people would be just astounded by his teachings on humility, on love, on scriptures, on true orthodoxy, on heresy, on all sorts of topics. And one day he gets really hung up on this very specific case of infidelity and divorce. And the people were kind of confused. Like, normally he spoke so beautifully on these specific topics. In this case, he was talking about something that was so particular, like, it just didn't mean anything to anybody. They couldn't figure out why he was talking about this until at one point, as people are kind of whispering, like, "Why is he talking about this?" Finally, a woman stands up and she says, "It's me he's talking about. It's me. I'm the one." He had been talking directly to her about her particular situation, even though she had never met him and never told him what had happened with her and what she had done. And she went with great tears and repented. And of course, he comforted her greatly in that. In addition to all of this, Elder Cleopa's life was marked by a very deep experiential knowledge of prayer. It caused him to instruct monks in a way that had been laid down long before him by St. Paisius Veličkovský, who we talked about in the last lecture. So this is why one of the books in English is called, of his life, is called Elder Cleopa of Siastria in the Tradition of St. Paisius Veličkovský, or something along those lines. Basically, Elder Cleopa was responsible for really revitalizing hesychistic prayer and deep spiritual life in Romania after communism. And it should be noted, by the way, that the two final monasteries in St. Paisius Veličkovský's life, we talked about Seku, and then he was forced by the prince to go to Neamț, they're literally just down the road from Siastria. And so when you drive from Neamț, you then go to Seku, and then right after that is Siastria. And there's just like three right in a row in the matter of just like, I don't know, a 10-minute drive. It's just such an incredible, beautiful place, so grace-filled. Though without formal education, Elder Cleopa was recognized among, again, about a dozen or so great elders and eldresses as the pinnacle of Romanian Orthodox spirituality. And so it was a very difficult thing for the country of Romania when he reposed in 1998. And he was buried right next to his old confessor, Paisiu Olaru, at Siastria. They have a beautiful cemetery there. I've been there a few times. So that's Elder Cleopa of Romania. Finally, we'll talk about one more person who, what I'm telling you about her is really all I know about her. I don't know a whole lot. There's no single text written about her life in English that I can find. But you can find things written about her from an Alaskan Orthodox priest. And I'm trying for the life of me to remember his name. I'll remember it here in just a second. Oleksa, Father Michael Oleksa, Oleksa. And I believe in the book Orthodox Alaska, A Theology of Mission, there's a chapter about this woman. But he also talks about her in the book Everyday Wonders, Stories of God's Providence. That's probably where I'd start with this. So Everyday Wonders by Father Michael Oleksa, Oleksa. And in that book, he talks about this incredible American personality who again is not officially glorified like Elder Cleopa, but she will be someday. Her name is Matushka Olga of Alaska. Matushka is the Russian word for priest's wife. So like in Greek you have presbytera, in Russian it's Matushka. So she was a priest's wife. Matushka Olga of Alaska is just one of my favorite figures in American Orthodoxy and one of my favorite modern saints. She was born on February 3rd in 1916 to an indigenous Alaskan family of Yupik origin. She was there was a Russian missionary in her town when she was born that spread the Orthodox faith among her community, and she was baptized as an infant. So she grew up learning to love praying, and she loved especially to pray for her family, so that by her teenage years, she already knew many liturgical hymns and texts in both the Slavonic language and the Yupik language. They would pray in both. Eventually, in an arranged marriage, she was married to a man of her village. And though he was a hardworking man, he wasn't really a churchgoer. And this and other things caused a lot of issues for her and a lot of strife early on in her marriage. But although they would argue a lot, she refused to despair and said she would take everything to prayer. She had learned this as a young child, just take everything to prayer. And she'd pray continuously. And she didn't question, you know, whether God was working or not. She knew in time things would improve. And eventually they did. Eventually the prayer worked. Her husband began to attend church. And he became so inspired by his own church attendance, he brought a lot of his friends with him. And it didn't end there. Miraculously, he began to consider the priesthood. And so he decided to go to a church school and learn a seminary education, or be educated in a seminary education. And he became Father Nikolai. Father Nikolai Michael was their last name. So he suddenly became Father Nikolai Michael, and Olga became Matushka Olga. Together, Father Nikolai and Matushka Olga Michael had 13 children, but five of them did not survive in the harsh conditions of Alaska and without the proper technology and medical services. Five of their children did not survive. Father Nikolai would spend much of his time serving not just his home parish, but there were 12 surrounding villages that didn't have a permanent priest, and so he would travel to them throughout the year, and Matushka Olga would accompany him. In the summer, when the rivers were thawed, they'd go by boat. But in the winter, they'd go by a snow machine that would go over the ice, or a dog sled. And Matushka Olga would travel with him and serve as a midwife. This was her job. She knew how to deliver children. In fact, she delivered her own children for the most part without the help of another person. And she became a midwife for many pregnant women. Matushka Olga would also spend her time at home doing what mothers do. She would keep her home. She would raise her children, she would cook, but she also spent a lot of time making vestments and baking prosfora and knitting scarves and gloves for her husband's fellow priests and various parishioners. At the time that she was alive, it was said that you couldn't find a priest in Alaska who didn't have something that was knitted by her. Everybody had something. She also would assist other women who were having difficulties in their home, and she would help them in just regular mundane things, helping them to cook and clean and rear children and showing them how to keep their homes. But she also became especially known for helping women who suffered from domestic violence. And what you may know this already, in Alaska they have a serious problem with alcoholism, being so secluded and so cold during the and having such long winters. So with a lot of alcoholism came a lot of domestic abuse. And people learned that they could go to her for comfort and good advice, and so they would go to Matushka Olga quite a bit. During her later years, parishioners began to be surprised because Matushka Olga would often know when women were pregnant before they knew it themselves. She'd go and congratulate them or tell them something about their future child without them even knowing it. And there were other little signs that she had spiritual gifts that were kind of informing her of what to say and how to live. And people began being very surprised by her. In 1979, Matushka Olga had contracted cancer. She refused to be consigned to a bed. She continued to work and to live as much as she could. And in November of that year, she partook of the Holy Mysteries and did confession for a final time. And she reposed on November 8th, again in 1979. She reposed in November. And in November, of course, in Alaska, there were many people very saddened because they simply couldn't attend her funeral. The rivers were frozen, but the ice wasn't thick enough yet for snow machines, and the ground was too frozen to even dig a grave. But a miracle occurred. On the day before her funeral, a warm front came in. It melted the rivers, so people were able to make it. It thawed the ground, so they could actually dig a grave for her. And when they carried her remains from the church to the gravesite, there were a flock of birds, a flock of summer birds in November, hovering above her casket and kind of guiding them. After her burial, they finished the burial, everyone went home, and winter weather returned again. And so this was a great miracle of God for her burial. After her death, people had dreams in which Matushka Olga would come to them, and she would sometimes foretell people's deaths, or she would heal them both physically and mentally and emotionally of wounds. There were people, still women, who had been battered or hurt in some way, and she would come and heal them. She was also seen in waking visions among those who knew her. There were times where people would hear a knock at the door and they'd open it, and there is Matushka Olga. And of course, they'd be shocked because she had already reposed, and yet she was there and would give them some sort of advice or lead them somewhere to some help for something. And finally, in the church where her husband was assigned, there were cases where photographs were taken of events in the church. And even though she had already been dead for months or years prior, some of those pictures would be developed, and there standing among the people was Matushka Olga, still there among the people, even though she had reposed. Matushka Olga has yet to be officially glorified, but she's already venerated by many thousands of Orthodox Christians today, and you can find a lot of icons of her that have already been painted, some not so great, some really beautiful, some really, really beautiful. So Matushka Olga, I wanted to make sure to put her on this list, because you've probably noticed most of the figures we've talked about are monastics, and many people look at this and they go, well, how is it that I'm supposed to follow these examples if you're just talking about monastics all the time? You know, what about non-monastics? Well, how can I become sanctified in my own household? Matushka Olga is proof. She is proof that we can be sanctified even in our own households, just living as husbands and wives, as mothers and fathers, as friends. Matushka Olga was somebody whose life was so simple and dedicated to Christ. Even with all the difficulties she lived, she never complained. She always sought Christ in all things. She always sought love for others. She always sought everything with humility. And she became a clairvoyant and in many ways a wonder worker. And so she serves as such a great example for us. We really pray that she will be glorified soon. Really, really pray that she'll be glorified soon. So again, if you want to read about her, Everyday Wonders by Father Michael Oleksa is a very, very short book. And I think you can get that one on audiobook. And then there's his, I want to say it was his dissertation, Orthodox Alaska Theology of Mission. That one I have not read, but from what I remember him saying in Everyday Wonders, the chapter in Everyday Wonders was essentially just adapted from a chapter in Orthodox Alaska where he talks directly about Matushka Olga. So, in all of these lectures, really the main theme has been that holiness is the true goal of our lives. And Christ has given us a church, the Orthodox Church, to serve as a hospital, to heal us from the sickness of sin, and to bring holiness into our lives and make us truly holy people. Everything the church has is to make us holy. Everything the church has. We can't be distracted by anything in the church. And if we're distracted from that goal of holiness, if we're not living every day with the thought of how can I become a little bit more humble, how can I love Christ a little bit more, how can I serve my neighbor a little bit better today, we're missing the point. Everything the church gives us is for this. And the lives of the saints serve as A, proofs that holiness is possible, and B, as constant inspiration for us to drive us in our own search for holiness. So I hope you've enjoyed all of these lectures. I hope you've really benefited from them. Again, I did things a little bit differently than I have in the past with this particular series of lectures. But I know I've really enjoyed it. And today, just to kind of recap, we've talked about these great figures that can teach us so much. So again, just to recap, in case you're taking notes, and I'm going to mention every book that I mentioned as well, we talked today about St. John of Kronstadt, who reposed in 1908. He wrote his spiritual classic, which was My Life in Christ, which is a spiritual diary. We talked about St. Nectarios, the Wonder Worker of Aegina, and his life can be read from Sotos Chondropolis, Saint Nectarios, a saint of our times, or Saint Nectarios, a saint of our century. We talked about Saint Siloan the Athonite. His life and teachings were passed down from Saint Sophronia of Essex in the book Saint Siloan the Athonite. We talked about Saint Joseph the Hesychast and his brotherhood and how he repopulated Mount Athos and has influenced monasticism all over the world, including greatly here in America through his disciple Elder Ephrem of Arizona. We talked about Saint John Maximovich of San Francisco, whose incorrupt relics were in San Francisco and continue to work wonders there literally on a daily basis, and his disciple Father Seraphim Rose. And I really recommend reading Father Seraphim Rose's life and works. We talked about Saint Porphyrios. Saint Porphyrios, this incredibly pure-hearted monk of Mount Athos, whose book Wounded by Love has been such an inspiration to so many people. I really recommend that. Saint Paisios the Athonite, who reposed in 1994, and the two books written about his life, both are again large but well worth your time. In fact, it's worth having both if possible. We talked about Elder Cleopa of Romania, who reposed in 1998, so very recent, how he revitalized Orthodoxy in Romania, and we anxiously await his glorification. There's a short book of his life called Shepherd of Souls, and then there's the longer version. That's an abridged one. I would read the longer version if you can find it. We've had it in the bookstore. Whenever I can find it, I get it. And I think it's called Elder Cleopa of Siastria in the tradition of Paisios Velichikovsky, or something along those lines. I forget exactly the name, unless you can find it really quick. Okay, I'm not finding it here. Okay, Elder Cleopa of Sihastria in the tradition of St. Paisios Velichikovsky. This can be a really tough book to find at times. But again, look for it in our bookstore, because whenever I can find copies somewhere, I make sure and grab a bunch of them. And then finally, after Elder Cleopa, we talked about Matushka Olga of Alaska, this great modern figure of our church who shows us how holiness is available even in married life. She's just an incredible woman, and God willing, we'll have a larger book about her life coming out soon sometime. So, God be with you all. Continue on your journey. We probably won't do another series of lectures until the fall again, but it'll be modeled after this one. I may add some other things. We may do a little bit of a longer series next time, but God willing, you've really benefited from these lectures. I know I've had a really good time giving them. Forgive me for having this last one just recorded without anyone actually here present in front of me right now, but this is just the way it worked out this year. So God be with you. May Christ continue to bless you on your journey towards Orthodoxy. May you embrace Him, His church, and His saints, which bring us such great spiritual benefit and bring us to salvation. Amen.